Couple of what?
Well, just some things about the Red Cross, what it was doing there, why it was there.
Yeah, that'd be good.
All right.
I'll turn this on and get this on.
Oh, what's this? Is this some of the memorabilia?
That's the stuff.
That's the stuff?
That's your box.
Uh-huh. Okay, great. Okay. Now, is this all of your...
Yes, take the stuff out.
Can I take that out and look at it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and then this is what you would like to ship to the archives, the Vietnam archives.
Yeah. The box, okay.
The whole box. Does this have your uniforms in it?
That's my uniform.
Oh, cool. Hey, look at these. Oh, and here's a nice picture. This is the repose.
Yes, that's it.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't know that was in there. That's it.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
Uh-huh. Oh, how many people were on that, do you know?
1,000.
Well, good heavens.
About 500 feet long. That's the little uniform.
Does it still fit?
I wouldn't even want to try it. I very much doubt it.
Oh, how nice. Pretty short.
Oh, yes.
Looks, I bet that was, and you have some pictures. Here's, this is nice. Look at this.
Right.
You got the American Red Cross on it. And do you have any other badges on it?
On the front, on the lapel.
Oh, yeah. That's nice. This is a real badge that you pinned on. And this is what you wore all the time?
No, that was the dress uniform. We had little blue dresses.
Darn it. You got to fold it all nice here. Let me...
It doesn't matter.
Make sure I don't... Oh, this was the dress uniform.
Yeah.
Class A, maybe, they call it.
Whatever
you called it.
Yeah.
And this is the Return to Meredith original, it says. Return to Meredith.
What are we...
There's a picture.
I didn't even look in there. What is it?
That's the picture of the repose.
Okay.
It's a smaller picture of the repose.
Yeah.
Do you want to keep that or anything?
No. Put it back in there.
Okay.
I didn't even know there was more in there than the dress.
Yeah, you haven't looked in here for a while.
No.
Oh, and here's the flag.
That's that flag.
Oh,
now,
my gosh.
That was not... That didn't belong to the Red Cross. That was the repose.
They
ship.
Gave this to you.
But I don't know where they flew it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, flag, Red Cross, size 6. DSA 12950. Oh, okay, and then here they hooked it onto the flagpole and flew it up there. Well,
yeah.
Looks like they flew it, I don't see a flag on this picture of the ship.
No.
But I don't see any flags on this ship, but I'm sure there are some... When they're out to sea, this looks like you're not out to sea.
It's a pretty little flag for such a big ship. I don't know if that...
That's great, though. Boy. And they gave you this.
Yes.
Like
the captain gave it to me.
Uh-huh. Like when you left?
Yep.
Okay. What year was that you left?
69.
What month?
October
of 69 you left? That's when I left.
Did you?
Yeah.
Really?
I got there in October of 68.
Right.
Is that when you got there?
Yeah.
It is?
Yes.
We were in Vietnam at the same time.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Did you?
No, but I thought probably about... I didn't know. No, I didn't. But I don't think we were in the same place.
Well, no, you were on the ship. And I don't know exactly, the ship went up and down the coast probably, didn't it?
The ship went from Da Nang north up to the DMZ, I Corps, they called it.
Yeah, I Corps.
So it was pretty far north.
Yeah. Well, I was in, at the bottom of I Corps, where 2 Corps started, that's where I was.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was south of Da Nang a little ways. We flew up to Da Nang one time to exchange our Charlie model helicopters for B models. We'd flown them. We'd worn out our Charlie models, and so we took them up to Da Nang and we exchanged them for some different helicopters.
Really?
Yeah. That's the only time I was in Da Nang. So I was a little bit. I was north of Quy Nhon.
Okay.
You know that's.
Well, you know. I never got off that ship.
I thought you told me you went into Da Nang once.
I did. Once or twice, maybe three times. Uh-huh. Now, what that means is that you get in a little boat, and they take you into the Navy Air Station or whatever. I mean, and you go in the officers' club.
Yeah.
And they have a drink or lunch or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I do remember being in the town of Da Nang maybe once.
But that was strange, wasn't it?
That was about it. And I remember the dresses that they wore, the women wore. I thought they were so pretty.
Oh, did you see those?
Split at the waist.
Yeah.
And then they had panels that went down.
You saw those?
Yes, I thought they were quite cute.
Yeah.
And I remember that they were such little people.
Yeah.
And
I remember them being small also.
Mm-hmm.
Just want to make sure that's going. Yeah, it's going.
And there are a couple pictures in here of their miscellaneous. These are the pictures that I have in are pictures that other people took and somehow either gave them to me or I acquired them somehow.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And let's in most instances, I don't even know where they came from.
Okay. You got a green certificate here and a green...
That's the little...
and here's a ship, the picture of the USS Repose, AH-16. Yeah. And an information bulletin, June 1969.
Now that is very good. That about has a couple of good things in it.
Uh-huh.
There's an article about the Red Cross on the Repose in there.
Okay.
And there's a very good article about the USS Chemung, which was a ship that refueled other ships at sea.
Uh-huh.
It was an oiler.
I see.
And we would be refueled at sea. We never docked, ever.
Yeah.
Except when we went to Subic Bay. I'll tell you more about that, but
okay.
That's all part of the ships thing, though. I mean, other people know much more about that than I do, but when we went to Da Nang, we would always anchor out in the harbor. We never went. The ship never, except when it went to Subic Bay in the Philippines,
yeah.
Which was a big naval base in the Philippines.
Right.
And they would put it in dry dock then. Mm-hmm. And they would, you know, scrape off the bottom and do the repairs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But otherwise, we were never...
You were always at sea.
Yes. And it was like a little world of its own, Ken.
So you were out there for an entire year?
Yeah.
Good heavens.
I know. Well...
That was a long time.
It was fine. I had things to do. But it was. It was
well,
like
you were pretty busy, I think.
I think so. But it was like a little world of its own.
Yeah.
The nurses wore white uniforms and caps. Now, this is a war zone.
Yeah.
These are nurses, like, they don't even know that it's a war zone. They're in their starched white uniforms, their little cap on their head.
Yeah.
The officers' wardroom on the ship was where you ate. It had white tablecloths, and the meals were served by Filipino.
Yeah, very traditional, right?
It was Navy. This is the Navy.
Traditional Navy.
Yes. So here you were with this. What are they? What were they called? The Filipino. I don't know, but they, you know, they have the.
They would serve your meals and everything. Yeah, yeah. Did you have sit-down meals?
Always.
Yeah, the Navy always did that. That was really nice.
Yeah, but it did. It was like you would not know you were anywhere near a war. And you were floating out here. I mean, you were like 3 miles offshore.
Yeah, and there was a lot of stuff going on 3 miles away. Well, you know, it was similar for us, even in sitting in an LZ English where we were, you know, we had electricity most of the time, so we didn't have air conditioning, but we had cold beer in a refrigerator, and just seemed like, well, it's pretty nice right here, you know. But then a few minutes later, it could be all different. You could be cranked up in your helicopter and out in the middle of it. The mountains and the jungle, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Just like you, I suppose things got pretty hot sometimes when... how did the flights come in? How did the soldiers arrive? And
helicopter. Wounded?
Do you remember what kind of helicopter?
There are a couple pictures. Big ones?
Big helicopters, little helicopters? Like, do you know the difference between Hueys and Chinooks and like that? Two blades... One blade?
There are pictures.
Okay. In this book?
More pictures.
That you took, maybe in another book. Now, this is a good book here.
It is.
Uh-huh. Oh, you're in this book. Meredith Klaus, right here. I should say that so this is Ken Embers, and I'm talking with Meredith Klaus, who was on the Repose. And you worked as, what was your official job title, Meredith?
Hospital Field Director. American Red Cross Hospital Field Director.
Okay. Meredith was the American Red Cross Hospital Field Director, and the hospital ship was the Repose. And you were there from October 1968 to October 1969.
Correct.
Okay. And it says in the book, the Formation June 96 Bulletin of the United States Navy. It says, whoops, I just lost my page. You're receiving some kind of award here. What is it? How many people were... There you are. It says, nice to have aboard. Repose skipper Captain John Drew gives Meredith Klaus Wright and Francis Clark Hardy, well done. Oh, you'd been there before. And so you remember this? Yeah. Is this when you were leaving? Ah, okay. So you two ladies, was she there with you the whole time?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
She was what was called the recreation director.
Uh-huh.
And... she had a different job.
Yeah, I see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there were a number of nurses aboard also, you said.
Yes, I think, I don't remember specifically. There were maybe 31, I don't remember, but...
And they were American Red Cross nurses?
They were Navy nurses.
Navy nurses.
The Red Cross... We were the only two Red Cross people.
Uh-huh.
And we were civilians. And we were the only civilians on board.
Oh, okay.
Which was no end of... you know, I mean, that was unusual.
Yeah.
To have a civilian on a Navy ship.
Right.
But historically, and all over the military... In any military hospital during a war, or even not a war, but any military hospital at that time had Red Cross personnel assigned to it. And they had specific job to do in the hospital that did not duplicate anything that the military did.
I see.
So... I probably ought to describe that job.
Yeah, because you
so people would have some idea of why on earth we were even there.
Oh, yeah.
Should I do that
now?
Yeah,
yeah. That's a good idea.
Can that thing hear me?
Oh, can this hear you? Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's hearing you real well. Okay. You can see it. Oops, I got to get my face ID on there so you can see it, so we can see it. But you see that green thing that's there? Yeah. Whenever you speak and that green thing,
is that your phone?
Yeah. Really? And it's got a recording device that, app.
Okay, all right. Well, the Red Cross had specific responsibilities or specific jobs in military hospitals. And so whether the hospital was in the United States or whether it was in Vietnam, there would have been a Red Cross person or two assigned to that hospital. So this was a hospital, and we were assigned there, and our biggest task was to provide a communication link between a service member and his family. And I think we don't remember particularly, but you probably do, there were no phones then. You couldn't pick up a phone and call your mother.
Oh, no.
There was no internet. Now it flabbergasts me.
They have contact every day.
I know. They're sitting in the middle of... I would think that would be very conflicting.
I do, too.
I don't know how you could function like that, but in any event...
Hi, Mom. Just a minute.
Yes, really. But anyway... So there was nothing like that. There was no way for a family to reach him. There was no way for him to reach, and except letters. Letters is how people corresponded. So in a hospital, if a service person was admitted to the hospital as a patient, and if they were judged to be, there were two categories that warranted the military advising the family, and that was they were seriously ill or they were very seriously ill. That was the official designation.
Mm-hmm. You wouldn't be on board unless you were either seriously ill or very seriously ill.
No, that's not true. You'd be on board if you had any medical problem at all, because there was no place else to go with you.
Okay.
There was nothing on land in a war zone.
Yeah. I'm talking about your people that came in from the war zone by helicopter.
Well, a lot of them. We had a lot of patients on the ship with just malaria.
Oh, you did?
Uh-huh. Yes, they were wandering all over the place.
And
the other big one was cellulitis.
What's cellulitis?
Cellulitis is sort of low-grade infectious process in the flesh part of, and it was because there was so much water, and they were wandering around in the water and the muck and in wet boots, and they would go days and never dry out, and then they would get this bacterial cellulitis, which was really difficult to treat. So not everybody. In fact, maybe the majority of patients were not wounded. They had other issues.
Well, just before I forget, I want to thank, I didn't tell it the date. Today is, what is the date? Today is August the 8th, 9th?
Hold it.
I forgot.
9th.
August 9th, 2021. I just, for the record, somebody will want to know that. Okay, so I didn't realize that. I thought only like wounded people, but six people that are disabled and not able to be in combat were also brought out to your ship.
Because when you think about it, where else would they go?
Yeah,
a combat unit would not be prepared to provide food, clothing, and shelter to somebody with malaria.
Right.
So it was the hospital.
Did you have mainly Marines, or did you have mainly Army guys? Or?
We were there. Our mission was to support the 3rd Marine Division.
Okay,
So I suspect most of them came by Marine helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
But we also had a fair number of Army, 101st Division. Somehow.
Yeah.
I don't know.
101st Airborne. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we had others too. I mean, there weren't just.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the 3rd Marine Division. So, back to the communication thing. So if the person or if the patient was seriously ill, very seriously ill, a message would go to the family advising that their service member, their family member had been admitted to the hospital, and a little statement that they were, you know, what might be wrong and what the prognosis would be and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be it from the military, but there might be a follow-up or whatever.
Kind of left them hanging, didn't it?
It did. And then a lot of families, the first they knew that anybody was in the hospital was when they got a letter from their son saying, "Hi, Mom, I'm here in the hospital ship." And of course, that would be just very anxiety-provoking.
What a shock.
So here's the glory of the system. Every single town in the United States is covered by a little Red Cross chapter, as we know.
Is that right? Yeah.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
And so the family could go to the local Red Cross chapter, which might be in their town or the next town or whatever, but there would be one.
Uh-huh.
They could go to the local Red Cross chapter. They could ask for, through the Red Cross, a health and welfare report. And then that would go to the National Red Cross in Washington, then to the Navy. And what they did have to communicate with was teletype. And that's how almost all the communication was done, was teletype machines.
Oh.
So then it went on to the Navy's teletype communication system,
mm-hmm.
to the ship, to the, you know, the military people on the ship,
mm-hmm.
and then to the Red Cross on the ship, to me.
Mm-hmm.
So then would come this message, so-and-so's mother is requesting information about her son.
Wow.
From whom she got a letter, yada, yada.
Well,
so then our job was to find this guy.
Yeah.
And eyeball him and say, "Your mother is worried about you."
What?
And what we did, we would get a statement from his doctor that about his condition,
doctor.
About him. And so the message going back would say, "Doctor states," it wasn't us that state, it was the doctor states, da-da-da-da-da, whatever the doctor was willing
Straight
to.
Straight information, yeah.
Yeah. And then...
Not second.
And your son says.
Uh-huh.
And so then he could send a message to his mother.
Uh-huh.
And then, lastly, letter coming soon. And we, if he could not write a letter, there was some impediment to that, then we would sit there and he could dictate the letter and we would write the letter home and get it sent off.
What a great service.
I think it was. I think it was well worth doing. Oh.
God, I never knew that existed.
I don't think most people did. And I don't... Are your knees hurting? No,
I just rub them all the time.
Oh, okay. So,
when I get excited, my knees sink. I rub my knees.
So unless you were... work for the record, you probably wouldn't. I don't think most people on the ship even knew what we did.
Oh, even on the ship?
No, not really. Yeah. I mean, they would see us
talking,
writing these letters, sitting there writing the letters, but they probably thought that's about all we did. But we did this other thing. And I think, and that was our biggest responsibility. We also, by the way, and I, can now add this little piece to it, provided all of the comfort supplies to to patients coming on board? So that would be the toothbrush, the toothpaste, the razor, you know, the soap, all that stuff. And because they came, they had nothing.
Yeah, you wouldn't have that.
So, and we supplied that in what we called a ditty bag.
Yeah.
And there's a story about the ditty bags that I need to share.
Okay.
Okay.
What's that?
The hospital ships were the project of an organization called the Colonial Dames of America. They are older and more elite than the DAR. Mm. They go back to the colonial times.
Colonial.
And as an organization, they adopted hospital ships historically. These were not the first hospital ships. I think they probably did it in other wars, if there was a hospital ship. So we were their project.
I see.
And I would get shipped these huge cartons of all of these comfort supplies, and huge cartons of these ditty bags. Now, a ditty bag was all over the military. They all had ditty bags, but these were made by the colonial dames themselves on their little sewing machines at home, and they were all made out of some colorful, wonderful fabric. They were not khaki. They were not like government issue.
Yeah.
So you would see these patients with these ditty bags hanging off the rails of their beds.
How big was a ditty bag? Like,
well, I've got one, wouldn't you know?
All right.
I think this might be the last remaining ditty bag.
In existence.
And I have kept this.
Oh, look at that.
And it does say inside here, made by the National Society of the Colonial Dames of America. So this was its ditty bag.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and now they got more colorful than this.
But that's nice, okay. Red and white stripes.
Yeah. So they sent these boxes of ditty bags, the comfort items, and also Polaroid cameras, an endless supply of Polaroid film.
Really?
So every time we would write this letter home, we could take a picture of the patient
or
two, which could be developed right away, Polaroid, include that in the letter, and send that off also.
Oh, my. What a relief for the people at home. What a service.
Who thought all this through? I don't know. But and the last thing...
It sounds like the Colonial Dames of America. It doesn't sound like the military. That's great.
They adopted. That's what they did. They adopted these ships.
Uh-huh.
It was their cause, you know?
All right.
And when I got home, I was assigned briefly in Pennsylvania. I forget the name of the hospital in Pennsylvania. It was an army hospital. Anyway, there was a chapter of the Colonial Dames nearby in Pottstown, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And her name was Potts.
Oh, my
from
goodness.
Pottstown.
Yeah.
And they invited me for lunch. And
how nice.
It was quite a little experience. Lunch with the Colonial Dames. But they did a lot. They were wonderful. And
you were their representative for a year.
Well, we were their... The Red Cross was their conduit. It's how they couldn't do it without...
Yeah.
You couldn't just ship stuff over there, you know.
Right.
But you through the Red Cross, they could ship it. It went through the Red Cross.
I see. Uh-huh.
Okay?
Let me hold that ditty bag.
Yeah, I think I've got some photographs in there.
Oh.
I've got quite a lot of photographs, Ken, and I've got little notes on them.
Oh, those are great. Have you shown those photographs to anyone?
No.
So
you know, nobody even wants to see them. Have you had this experience?
Yes.
Have you? You have friends and you think they would care. They don't. You say, I'm working on these things for Vietnam. Somebody's going to come and get them. Okay, well now, where did you say you kept your what? Nobody's interested.
This is the main point of this interview.
What? That nobody's interested? You're interested.
It was so hard for everybody to come back, and nobody gave a shit.
That's right. They didn't. It wasn't hard for me because I didn't feel like I ever left.
Yeah, but you did.
If you want the truth of the matter.
But when you came back, you had spent a year doing some great service there. And normally, you know, World War II, there would have been a big parade and you would have been a hero. And your service would have been appreciated.
Well, this was, you came back and I came back in the height of the anti-war movement.
Exactly.
And pretty much I agreed with them by that time.
I did too.
It seemed ridiculous. I mean, it was worse than ridiculous. That's not a good word. It was a travesty.
Right.
And it was just confusing.
It was very confusing.
There are many more pictures, Ken.
Oh, my gosh. Look at these. And you haven't ever shown them to anyone.
No, I have not.
Because no one ever expressed an interest.
What have you got there?
I got pictures of guys that were in the hospital.
Oh, okay. All right.
I'm just leafing through them, and all these guys are so happy to see you and have you take a picture. And, you know, it's like an incredible service that here somebody's giving a guy a birthday cake. And he's pretty happy about that. Here one of you are talking to a guy and he's all bandaged up, his arm, and here's other people, a doctor taking care of him. You know, I said these kind of photos should, you know, be in a some kind of a retrospective of the service that you provided and people like you, you know, this has not ever been. I guess this is why we're giving them to the Vietnam archives.
And without you, I think I might have thrown all this out when I moved.
Well,
because I was throwing stuff away right and left.
You know, like these guys look so happy. You know, they're all crippled up and they're in chairs and wheelchairs.
Oh, those three out on the deck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they got a cigarette and they got some caps on and they're.
The people on that ship that kept track of stuff, you know.
Uh-huh.
We had a chaplain, we had administrative people, we had translators, you know, they wouldn't just leave off a child and we wouldn't know where they would know where the child came from and
yeah.
Whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the medical issues were with the children, whatever, but
right. So here are random photos of crew members. You don't even know what happened to the children. Maybe they went back or
I do not.
Yeah. Probably they were there for a while and then went back somewhere. Wow, these are great photos. Here you got photos of the crew members. And they're doing different things. Hanging out with each other, and they're playing guitars, and you guys are singing some songs here. Looks like a little relief for people. These guys are hanging out. Here they're having some snacks and some food. And guys are sailors are happy to see you, and they're looking around, and These guys are looking pretty serious. They got a job to do, and some of these guys have a job to do. Okay. And people gave you all these pictures.
They did.
Pretty much.
Well, we had a photographer aboard, too.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't know which were his, but...
Yeah.
Everything was documented on film.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm just going to go ahead and look at these. You've got them all nice in envelopes and marked there, random photos. I think I'll keep these down here. And photos of a ham radio operator. Okay, on board the ship, you had a ham radio operator?
We did.
Yeah.
And that was how you could actually call home.
There was no place, no email, no phones. The only communication was by letter for service members and for officers' teletype machine. Yeah, and business. These people look awful young.
Well, he was our ham radio operator, and he could patch calls through. You know how they do that.
I know. We did that once.
Did you?
I can't remember what we called it. But there was some kind of thing where we lined up, and we got a chance, and we called home. And we actually talked to our parents. I talked to my mother and my dad, my father. And they remember getting the call.
Uh-huh.
You know, they said we had some friends over, and we were sitting around talking, and we got this phone call that said it was somehow from you somewhere.
Uh-huh.
It's great. Okay, now this is a talent show that you had. Must have been something that to entertain the troops.
That was the Fantail Follies.
Oh, Fantail Follies.
So, that was another responsibility of the Red Cross, and that was the recreation director.
That was another person, or that was another
type? That was the other Red Cross person.
Okay.
And she did special events and things like the Fantail Follies and art shows and little concerts or whatever, things for patients that were in bed, you know, games, puzzles, whatever, to keep time flowing and whatever, and she was very good at it. She did a good job, but the big things were these quarterly big events, and we had this thing called the Fantail Follies, and it was amazing to me the amount of talent.
Oh, I see you have pictures here of people.
That's the art show. Yeah,
that's an art show.
Yeah,
and then you said the amount of talent, like
for the the amount of talent sang. In that crew. I mean, it came out of nowhere. One of the most amazing things was the neurosurgeon was an unbelievable banjo player.
Is that right?
Yeah, and who knew? And but there were all kinds of other I wish I had more pictures from that, but I don't.
Here it says, you also have a note here, this is about the art show, but also on here it says, refueling at sea.
What?
Refueling at sea. Someone in the Navy would know much more than
I
about this.
Let me see that. That got lost.
Okay, that was supposed to be on something else. It's on the other side. Oh, I see. You used that piece of paper for two things.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Okay, you probably remember. These are these two pictures of you and...
Okay, that's the art show. But somewhere are some pictures of refueling at sea. We'll leave the art show over here.
Okay.
Where did you see Fantail Follies?
Oh, that's in here.
Did you go through those?
Yeah.
Let's see.
We had a talent show. This is the casino night, talent show, and the art show. We're all in this.
Okay. Okay, now, you want it? You breezed right over the casino night.
We haven't got there yet.
You don't want to do that.
We didn't get there yet.
Yes, you did. This is it. All right. So.
It's all into this envelope. We haven't covered
it. All right, now, this is the casino night. This was another Red Cross event.
Okay.
And you look at those. And
yeah.
The first one, I think, is a roulette wheel.
Yeah, you got a roulette wheel there somebody made.
Okay, they made that. The crew made that out of the Red Cross ping pong table. As I said, this crew was extremely talented, and I'm pretty sure that thing was perfectly balanced. And I had that ping pong table on my inventory, and so I had to account for that when I left. And it was no more. So I'm sure I lied my way out of that. I don't know. But so then... No, you're going too fast here. On the table. Notice on the table.
Yeah.
The roulette, the...
Yeah.
You see that?
Yeah. Numbers.
We wrote to a casino in Las Vegas and said we were on this hospital ship in Vietnam. We were going to do this casino night. And would they send us anything they could?
Yeah.
In support of our casino night. And we got back this box of wonderful stuff. From the casino.
In Las Vegas?
Yeah. Casino. Oh, people would do anything. So we got that nice top for our roulette table, and we got all kinds of cards and dice and,
That's great.
I know. So I wanted to be sure you saw that.
Yeah.
Okay. Then what else is there?
Well, there's a picture of a gentleman that looks like he shouldn't even be there. He's all dressed up. And
that's the captain of the ship.
The captain of the ship.
And I think he's dealing blackjack.
Okay, and he's all...
He got in his white...
Dress whites.
Well, no, that's a dinner jacket.
Uh-huh.
So... And that was quite a thing for him to come and do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. For the crew. The crew was most amazed.
Yeah, I'll bet they were. And he was like the guy that called out the numbers and did things. And he was, that's really cool. The captain of the ship came in. He looks like some sort of a French casino owner, you know. And these guys are having fun. Playing something here, you know, they're...
That's more...
More casino
activities.
This
was an extremely successful event, and those were probably the Filipino...
I see there a little bit.
Yeah.
Although stewards? We call them stewards, I think. And here were people that, you know, servicemen that were on the ship. That's great. Is that about midway through your tour, or hard to remember?
Yeah, probably.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And these are the casino night pictures, and also to go into those casino night pictures,
let's
I don't think...
Let's put this... Let's see one. Where's the Fantail Follies pictures?
It's in here. Those were all in this envelope here. You had three sets of pictures in this. Okay. Okay. And what about those other pictures over there?
These are the art show.
And then
that
was in there also. Mm-hmm. And didn't you have something on them like that? It says the art show on one side there. See, it says art show.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to the pictures refueling at sea. It doesn't matter.
Well, you'll probably come across those, and we'll put them. You might have put another folder on them. You got these really nicely done.
Yeah. I didn't write on the pictures.
No.
Is that okay?
I think that's perfect. All right. I think the way you got it was just perfect. I do think we ought to maybe show these to somebody before we send them to the archives. Who? Like Pat.
Who?
My wife, Pat, your good friend. She would love to see him.
Oh, I don't think.
I do. She didn't know me before I went to Vietnam. She didn't know anything about that.
Have any pictures you brought back?
Oh, yeah.
Did you?
Sure. Yeah.
Has she seen those?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's been with me to my reunions. And now she's starting to understand what the Vietnam War was all about. But she didn't know. She went to Europe, right?
Yeah.
She went to Germany. She went to France.
Yeah.
Norway.
Yeah. She went to Germany.
Went to Germany for a long time. And then she came back for a while, and then she went to France. Mm-hmm. And that's where I met her, in France. So she really didn't know about Vietnam. She didn't know about the people. But now she does. She's been to Vietnam with me one time.
I know she did.
So she would love to see these. I'm going to take them.
It's all right.
And I'm going to show them to her. But I think it'd be better if you showed them to her. But I don't know how you can do that. Maybe
I can't. And you know what?
What?
I'm kind of tired of them. It took me all week to get this together. And I'm done with it.
All right.
I'm, as they say, I'm over it.
There you go. Okay.
I mean, I'm happy to go through this with you because this is the first time I've ever had anybody to talk to about it. But I'm pretty sure when we finish this, I won't want to do this again anytime soon.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, we will have the pictures and we will have the recording, and we can put that together. And
well, you can do that in Kansas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so there was no point. Okay, we've gone over these. Yeah, we've gone over these. And this was part of this one right here. It's falling. I don't even know anything in there. So this was the ham radio operator. Yeah, okay, we got that guy. And we got the random photos. We got these guys. We haven't looked at these yet. Okay, got a couple more. Here's the Subic Bay dry dock. And this is in the Philippines then. Pictures in the Philippines, right? And you've got quite a few of those outside in the Subic Bay and the dry dock at Subic Bay. And you took some time there and went through these. I don't think I'm going to go through every one of these right now.
No, you don't need to.
These are ones when you're at dock. I just want to look at them. What's Olongano?
Olongapo.
Olongapo. Is that a place in the Philippines?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, you can open that.
Okay.
Let's
see what that is. It's in a little different kind of folder here. Oh, that's just a picture rolled up.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
all right.
Wow. That is a big event that you had, party or something.
What that is, Olongapo is the little town that is right outside the gates of Subic Bay. Those are all prostitutes. And there is a great stampede out the gate to Olongapo.
You bet.
Yes.
And pretty girls.
Yes, indeed.
Really cute girls.
And we had such a great rapport.
Nice girls.
With the staff, and there are the two of us.
I see
you.
Do
you see him?
Yeah.
Right down here?
Uh-huh.
Really?
I see you.
You met you? Really?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
You're round eyes.
Oh, jeez.
There's a difference.
You have good eyesight. But, so that was quite a big thing, and,
this is too good.
And the crew claimed the girls in Olongapo knew about the movements of every ship in the 6th Fleet or whatever before anybody else did. don't know.
I like the photo in the background, too.
Oh, God, I didn't even notice that.
Perfect.
Look at that.
Yeah, that should be on a T-shirt somewhere. Yeah, that you should frame that one, Meredith.
Well, I think it should go, don't you?
I'm going to take a picture of it.
Okay.
That is too great. I love it. And those guys have never been happier since they left home.
Mm-mm.
It's like, holy smokes, this is the greatest. Yeah, that's wonderful. That is a great picture. I'm glad you told me to open it.
Yeah. Well, I didn't want you to miss that.
Yeah.
I've dragged that all over.
And nobody gets to appreciate it before, right? So no. This is something that goes beyond cultural norms, right? You know, it's like, those girls are what? Those guys are happier than they ever have been. Everybody's happy. Well, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Well, and you know, the truth of the matter is, those girls were supporting whole families doing
that. Oh, yeah. That was a lot of money for them, what they received.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm just going to quick look at these pictures that are on the dry dock when you're in Subic Bay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's much quieter times, much happier times there. And then you did an inspection in dress whites, it says.
Oh, yes.
Maybe for your arriving. Yeah, oh, yeah, there's the... Yeah, everybody's got their dress whites on. Yeah. Oh, guys getting ready to pull in. You're out of the combat zone, and you got to dress up, and everything's spick and span. Go Navy. Those are good pictures.
You know, I looked the ship up.
If you get tired and want to take a break, let me know.
No. I looked it up. Googled it.
Yeah.
In 1975, it was decommissioned.
Oh, really?
And sold for scrap.
Oh, yeah.
Really? Yeah.
Should have been parked out here in Lake Erie. That would have been
a good idea. I'll tell you another little story. Here's another little story.
Okay.
We had all these ambulatory patients.
Yeah.
Have we not been recording?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure.
We had all these ambulatory patients, you know, these malaria patients and whatever, roaming about. And we had ambulatory wards. I mean, there were wards, they were, you know, ships come in decks.
Yeah.
So the farthest down were the ambulatory patients, whatever. The ship was full of cockroaches, and
I never thought of that.
Oh yes, and in fact, if I opened my desk drawer in the morning, I would open my desk drawer and I would stand back.
Oh no!
Like that, and
oh no!
Oh yes, and so the malaria patients had contests of who could catch the most cockroaches, and they had prizes. And
how'd they catch them?
I don't think they could be too, but my God, they are the smartest little critters. They were big. They were, you know.
And those are the Asian cockroaches.
And what?
They have special cockroaches that are bigger.
On the Navy?
Well, no, Asian Oriental cockroaches. There's a kind of cockroaches.
Oh, really?
Bigger. Yeah, they must have had those.
I don't know.
They're bigger than the ones around here.
I don't know. They were good size.
Uh-huh.
Like that.
Good, healthy size.
And they did have, they did spray.
Yeah.
But, so.
Well, cockroaches are one of the oldest known forms of life's prehistoric existence, mm-hmm. still existing.
Mm-hmm.
Before the dinosaurs and all. Yeah. They're still here.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what made me think of that, but...
They run away when the lights come on and mm-hmm. hide.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, that's an important detail. So you said it was, you wouldn't ever know you were not in the States or something, you said. But I think that's a little detail that maybe told you that you were somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Or big cockroaches come at you when you open the door of your office or the drawer in your office.
And the places on a ship for a cockroach to hide, just, I mean, the nooks and crannies and pipes and lines and, you know, I mean, it just...
Yeah, they're everywhere, huh?
They're everywhere.
Okay, and here says there was... Oh, okay, wait a minute. No place, no phones, no email, okay, communication
by letter. Oh, that's the radio operator again.
Oh, I opened that again. Oh, God, what am I doing? Opened the wrong one. Let me get on here. Yeah, why did I open that one again? Random photos, and then we did that, and we did Subic Bay guys, and we've done... Okay, we haven't done these yet. The photographs, USS Repose, refueling at sea.
Oh, finally we found it.
Yeah, refueling at sea. And now you've got another note on there about refueling. An amazing operation, he says.
Yeah, now this would be something in the Navy they would know a lot about, and they wouldn't need me to say anything about it at all, but... It was quite astonishing, I thought. These two big ships, and they run parallel to each other through the water, and they're not going slowly. They're going, you know, fairly fast.
Yeah.
And then they, you know, this line goes from one ship to the next.
Oh, I see. A couple of lines.
Yeah.
Big lines.
Yeah. I think it's a very skilled operation, really.
Mm-hmm. I see, and the waves are beating up there, they're moving along.
But almost every ship in the Navy, that's how they're refueled.
Yeah, that's a, what you call it, some kind of a tanker or an oiler? Yeah, and everybody's out there working away, and then, ooh, I see the waves splashing up. See guys signaling up here, the signalman signaling to the other ship. We've got the hoses attached. Oh, good heavens.
And sometimes they would sometimes send other things, you know, little special packages or something.
Oh, yeah, across, yeah.
They'd use that opportunity to... I mean, you can almost hear it. You know, we're going to go out and refuel the Repose. Does anybody have anything they need to go to the Repose? And so then they could rig up another line in a little basket. And,
yeah, right. And I've heard sometimes they exchanged ice cream and steaks and different kinds of, I don't know, things that they did. This didn't have a label on the front, but it's got inside several things. It says supplies coming aboard. Move to hold with chain gang. And so this shows everything came aboard by sea, at sea by helicopter. Best of all, the mail. Oh, yeah.
Now, I shouldn't say that because I think when we were in Da Nang, that's when we got a lot of supplies.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think...
Yeah,
I think that came on boats.
Yeah, here's a big, nice big twin rotor Chinook.
Is that it?
Yeah, bringing supplies aboard for you. And they had such big supplies there. They were sling loading that. Yeah, bringing that aboard. Yeah, and a lot of guys on the staircase there coming aboard.
That's how they moved it.
Oh, okay, I see. They handed it up along a line.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, then nobody carried it. They moved it. Right. Yeah, I see. Okay. Let's see. I put these here. these. I didn't look at these yet. You went through a lot of work.
Well,
you've
considering
got
I'd put it off for years, I mean.
50 years.
Well, how long you've been sort of encouraging me to do this, and I just keep...
Here's the day in port. Crew that got Liberty could take one of the small boats and into the Danang Naval Station in country. Oh, yeah. Whoa, yeah, go ashore. Why would you want to go ashore? You had everything you wanted on board except the girls. All right. This is great. Everybody's going aboard.
Is there a long stairway that they're walking down?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Long stairway. See those guys?
If you turn off your... Can you turn that thing off?
Turn it off? This is the military. All stories are... Okay. What are those guys so excited about going down that stairway?
You don't have to turn it off. It's okay. I don't need to... No, it's not. It's a story about myself. The first time I went into Da Nang and went to the Da Nang, the officers' club, and I drank too much. And they had to carry me up that staircase. And you can see at the top of it, you know, there's the railing for the ship, and they're all hanging over the railing, watching me being.
I said,
and it was days before I came out of my office.
They said, she's one of the boys.
I made a little dash to my office in the morning, and there I stayed. Unless I had to go do something. I was so humiliated. So if I say I didn't go out much, that's about right. Okay.
And I bet they said, she's one of the boys. All right. That's what they said.
I don't know.
Hey, she's one of us. Mm. They had to carry us back, too. A lot of those guys came back like that.
I don't know. Maybe so.
Yes, they did. Okay. Yes, they did. That's what you went aboard for. That's why you went ashore. These guys, I had some friends in the Navy said, what'd you do when you got ashore? We drank until we couldn't walk. And then somebody carried us back.
Did you have a did you have any kind of a base or an officer's club or any kind of
At LZ English we had a kind of a shack that had Monopoly in it, and we sometimes had whiskey in there, but it was not a real club. We were on an LZ landing zone. And but although it was a big one and we supported 173rd Airborne Brigade, there was no running water or anything like that at where we were. This was a temporary base, but we were there for a year or more. It was kind of a mistake. In other words, it was only supposed to last for a while, but it turned out that it lasted a lot longer than that, and so they never did. It was only halfway through, you know, that I was the gunship platoon leader, but you also had other duties as an officer, and my duty became to procure the lumber to build hooches, because everybody lived in tents. We didn't even have those little hooches with the wood going up half the way and screen and then a roof. People didn't have that. And this was unauthorized, but my commanding officer says, I'm going to put you in charge. You go figure out how you can get lumber from the engineers and build us some hooches for our enlisted men and our warrant officer pilots. And I didn't know how to do that, but I had an E6 sergeant that had been in the military, and he knew what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we had a sergeant.
they
ran things.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
They could. You're coming to something with just that very thing.
That theme.
We're going to talk just a minute about the procurement of lumber, which was very hard to do. There was no lumber. And unless they were, I don't know where they got, but.
They were like magic.
Ask where he got it either, did you?
No. All we did one day was he said, we got to go to this other small LZ where the engineers are stationed with our helicopters. And they loaded up the lumber and we took it back. And wait a minute, not all the lumber. Some of the lumber, somehow they drove in trucks over to our place. I can't remember how they did all that. But we had barracks for all our men in our area.
Who built them?
They built it. The men built it themselves, and the sergeant was in charge. You know, he knew how to build stuff. I don't know how he knew how to do that. You know, he was in charge, and he had all the crews, and they had built it all. And they were happy to because they had hard floors then, you know.
Yeah.
And they had screens, and they put their cots in there, and it was real nice. Didn't stay there long. You know, once we got that all built, then the Army said, oh, well, it's time for you guys to move somewhere else, you know.
Oh, gee.
So, you know, we were there about maybe 6 months or 4 months. They had been there about a year, and nobody had had everybody living in tents except what they call the RLOs, the real live officers. Those were commissioned officers, the warrant officers called them RLOs. They had built a kind of an officer's hooch out of ammo crates. So it actually had a wood floor, and then the receiving leaked and everything. But it was at least it had a kind of a wood floor up off the ground. But then everybody else had nicer hooches when we got this other lumber in, you know. And then later on, after we left, and I went back to the United States, at a reunion we had, one of the guys that had been in our unit said, you know, I went back for a second tour, and I was in the helicopter gunships in this one unit. And as we were leaving, giving up at 73 and leaving, he said, our mission was to go back and blow up those hooches.
Oh.
So that the NVA couldn't have them. Oh. So they went back and blew them all up. I thought, oh, our hooches. That's war, isn't it?
It's terrible.
Isn't that terrible?
Yeah,
I felt terrible. I said, oh, I went to all that trouble doing all that. I didn't build them, but anyway.
And that poor population could have used them.
They could have used them.
Yeah.
We've been back there to that runway, and there's a... The runway is still there, and there's a monument that says, to the valiant NVA soldiers that drove out the Americans in 1973 or something like that.
Anyway.
Here's the captain's gig picture with some, well, one picture. Back, captain's gig, was that his boat or something?
Yep.
Okay. All right, the captain on the ship. So, you and I were there at the same time. Now, that is just amazing. I did fly out to a ship one time, but it was not a hospital ship. I took something out there. Okay, so we've seen this. Lifeboat drill, we haven't seen that. This was on board the ship whenever you had a drill. Okay. Were you in this boat?
Mm-mm.
Okay, but people practiced lowering the boats and getting in them, and in case they had to abandon ship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. And then here's miscellaneous pictures of the ship, and showing at different times what things that happened. Oh yeah, there's some pictures of the ship. Big old chains and hooks and ropes they had. My gosh. Walk around that ship. Did you sometimes just walk around or exercise? You were on duty, I guess, 24/7, but you had sort of office hours or something.
Oh, whatever.
You always had a...
Somebody could always find you.
Yeah.
They knew where you were all the time.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Yeah, you're on
a
ship.
They you had no privacy.
Right. You have your own cabin? Did you?
It was a nurse's quarters.
Uh-huh.
That was sort of...
That's where you stayed, slept?
That's where the nurses and the Red Cross were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so did you have a bunk or a cot?
It was a bunk.
Two bunks, upper and a lower, and everybody had upper and a lower.
Uh-huh.
And you had showers.
I think, yes, we did.
But in the Navy, my dad, who was in the Navy in World War II, when I'd take a shower at home, he'd say, you're using too much water.
I know. They have to make all the water on board.
Yeah. So your showers...
Don't ask me how they do that. I don't know, but they have to make it.
Yeah. They desalinate it. And did you take a Navy shower where you went in and you got wet, and then you soaped up, and then you turned on the shower to rinse off?
You know, the women on board that ship were absolved of any rules. I mean, there were...
You didn't have to take a shower.
Well, you didn't... Your showers were not limited in time. I don't... It was a very privileged...
Uh-huh. So you got to take showers as long as you wanted.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, they probably said... Let the girls tell.
You know, but then another thing, though, I could say, we were civilians. There were the two of us, and we were civilians. We were not military.
Yeah.
And because of that, we were always sort of odd men out. I mean, there's no room in the military for a civilian. They don't actually know what to do with civilians.
Exactly, right.
And they just hope and pray you behave yourself. Because they don't have, you know, mechanisms to deal with you. And
right.
But it also means that you don't always know what's going on.
Right, you're
not
in the chain.
You're not in the inner,
you're not in the loop there.
No, not really.
Uh-huh.
So the other thing that is different if you're a civilian is the Navy is very strict, or it was very strict, about officers and enlisted fraternizing.
Especially the Navy. Yeah, it was. Right.
And we were civilians.
Right.
And so, I sort of took that as I didn't really need to follow that rule.
There you go.
And I was... So we kind of did a lot with... did a lot.
You fraternized with enlisted men?
Well, we certainly talked to them. We certainly hung out with them.
Yeah, that's cool.
We rail hanging is a big thing in the on a ship. Rail hanging.
Yeah.
And so I didn't feel constrained by any.
Yeah.
And I guess it was okay because nobody ever called me on it or...
Right.
But I don't...
Even though you'd be considered an officer.
Well, I for certain things.
Yeah.
But
right.
Not really.
Well, not a military officer, but a Red Cross. The Red
but
Cross
I was
hierarchy.
A civilian. I was not in the military. Yeah. Okay. So. It's a funny little thing.
Oh, yeah?
But that's part of all that training you get beforehand. I mean, the 2 years at Fort Dix, there's all this little stuff that you come to know about. You know,
bunch
the little
of...
rules and regulations of the military.
Yeah.
Which who would know? And
nobody knows, and you can't even figure out, and you would think, like, what?
Okay, here. I think this might be the end.
The end?
The end.
I think it's beginning. This is stuff we need to have made a little bit better known.
Well, I don't know how they're going to... You know, I read this that, you know, this could sit down there for 20 years and nobody would ever...
That's why we're going to make it a little bit better known before we send it to
them. Well, I don't know how we can do that.
Well...
And I don't know, Ken, honestly, that it's any more important.
Whoa, look at all those pictures.
All right. All of this is Christmas aboard that ship.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
I remember Yeah, Christmas.
Oh, here's more of the children.
Yes, it would be Christmas 1968, right?
Right. However... Yeah.
So they brought children aboard?
Okay.
For Christmas?
No, they were already there. So here's the children at Christmas.
Wow, you had children.
Now, the one thing, all of these are, the crew decorated this ship up the wazoo. There was no place on the ship that did not get decorated. And for starters,
Oh, your favorite children.
No, picture. My favorite picture. And those are the guys that painted that banner that went on the smokestack.
Merry Christmas. And the Red Cross emblem.
Well, that's the smokestack of the ship.
Uh-huh. These guys are painting on there.
And didn't they do a wonderful job? I mean...
Yeah. All right. Now they... Somebody got the paint together and did all that.
And this...
did you have a safety pin for
that? Yeah, here.
Okay. Now, I have these. Were all of these in the ditty bag?
Well, it doesn't much matter.
Okay.
They're all going to go in this box.
Yeah, okay.
How are you going to get this box back to Kansas?
I'll put it in my luggage. I brought extra luggage.
You did?
Yeah, because I thought you'd have something.
I think that's interesting. Okay. I have no idea where we got live evergreen Christmas trees on that ship.
Oh my goodness.
Think about it. Where in the earth would they have come from? If I knew, I have forgotten. I don't know. But the other remarkable thing is, you said procuring lumber.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where they got the lumber to make the stands for those Christmas trees.
Yeah.
But we had maybe 20 of those little Christmas trees.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that amazing?
And I see they're making the stands there in that picture.
Yes, they are. And where did they get that lumber? Who would know? Christmas was a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
So these are all Christmas pictures.
Okay.
On the ship.
Okay. This
goes
with it.
Can I have these in here?
Yeah.
You don't have to go through those.
I want to look at them. Okay. And I'll look at them in more detail. You know, I'm going to go through this in more detail before I send them to the archives. And I'm going to share them with Pat. And she's going to just flip out. And I might arrange them in some kind of... manner to kind of show the narrative, if I might. I'd like to put them together in a little kind of thing to show what you did, because it's indicative of what a lot of other Red Cross people did. And
it's Christmas.
You never see. I want to show these to my fellow pilots that were in the 61st Assault Helicopter Company.
You know, I have no idea.
Those people will really appreciate this.
I'm going to get a piece of chicken.
Yeah, go ahead. You better. Oh, it looks like you're singing some hymns too, huh? Singing Christmas songs?
What?
Looks like you're singing Christmas songs here.
They probably are.
Christmas carols. And there's a nurse singing, and there's Santa Claus and the reindeer. Wow. And here's a happy dude. Here's Santa Claus. I don't know what Santa's doing without any pants on, but he's got some garters on.
What?
Is this picture you? Oh, I'll ask you when you come back. Okay, let's,
Are you through those?
Yeah, they're great.
Are you through all the pictures?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now turn your attention to...
Turn my attention to what?
The yearbook.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet. Just a minute. Okay, I am looking at these people-to-people, people-to-people program, yeah.
Oh.
Pictures of the people-to-people program, isn't it? And now you have a yearbook here?
Yes.
You want to take a break while you eat?
No.
Map of the war area. Oh, boy, this is cool. What is this?
That is a yearbook. Not there during the time that yearbook was put together. I was already gone.
Okay.
So I don't know any of the people in it. I'm not in it.
Oh, this
and
is the yearbook.
I don't know how I got it.
This is dedicated to all the men and women who served aboard the Repose during the years 1966 and 1970. Oh. Table of contents, hospital section, medical service corps, ship's company, candid camera. Oh, this is great. History of our ship. And it tells everything. 67. 112. The high was in 1967. They admitted 112 patients in one day. And in January of 69, they had 10,000 helo landings. What? Oh, 10,000th helo landing on 27 January. Patients were returned to full duty, and over 7,000 medically air evacuated to other Pacific commands. Oh my gosh. This book is really amazing. The commanding officer there. Looks like a pretty knowledgeable guy. Robert Frederick Menge. M-E-N-G-E. Menge?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lived a life at the sea. Pretty good. And the commanding officer of the Naval Hospital, Captain Arthur J. Draper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He looked like a good guy. The executive officer of the Naval Hospital, Captain Lindsay C. Getson. here are people being, here are pictures of nurses and doctors and surgery, neurosurgery, orthopedics, Department of Medicine. Wow, everything. Lots of nurses' pictures. Code 99, a race against death. Anesthesiology, pathology, radiology, urology, Department of Dentistry, intensive care unit.
What?
The intensive care unit, surgical supply, medical service corps, pharmacy. This was taken after you were there, you say?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, because the...
No, no.
The field director there then was Miss Jane Cooper. That would be after you, huh?
Yeah, I guess so. I never met her.
And Miss Frances Clark was the recreational director.
Now, Frances Clark was there with me. And she must have stayed on for a week or so or something.
Hmm.
Long enough to get her name in there, but...
Miss Janet Blank's recreational director also. Mm-hmm. It must have been the new one, and she stayed a little bit.
Evidently.
No, too bad they missed your picture. Here's Miss Clark writing a letter for a patient, the American Red Cross. Yeah, well, they got room for your picture. We might just put that in right there. Hospital personnel, ship's executive officer, 1st Division. You said you supported the 3rd Marine Division.
Right.
And other units like the, who'd you say, 101st Airborne?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Yeah. And probably a lot of other people. Engineering and the E Division. Lots of people make it go. Yeah. Down in the engine room. Did you ever go down in the engine room?
I did not.
Uh-huh.
They didn't want me in the engine room.
Well, I probably didn't allow you. Okay. And here's the... It says, the cream of our nation visits the repose. Now, who would these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 ladies
be? Well, that
be?
Would be the, those USO things that would come through.
Oh, the USO people?
Yeah, you know, they'd...
They'd come through, too?
They'd come... we would have them on the ship. They were a big hit.
Uh-huh.
Did you ever get a USO person?
Yeah, we had two come to our unit, Donut Doll, as we call them, and they... But I never saw them. They were in the helicopter, and they'd fly out to the field a little bit. I mean, a lot. And they would talk to different guys, and they called them Donut Dollies, but they never had donuts because nobody had donuts in Vietnam. It was too hot.
I don't know if there were Donut Dollies in Vietnam. Donut Dollies were in World War II.
Well, that's what we called them.
I know. Everybody does. Everybody always calls you that. But that's not...
Well, that's definitely not what you were. Oh, yeah, here's all kinds of pictures here.
I think that's a great thing. My friend Peggy, who was in the Navy, a naval officer,
mm-hmm.
said that putting a yearbook together is a common thing on any naval ship.
Oh, yeah?
But she said they don't always get it done or do it.
Yeah, it took them a while to get it.
But at the end of a assignment or...
Mm-hmm. A tour?
I guess so.
Okay. And so here is, you want to take a nap?
No.
Take a little break? Okay, go ahead. Don't worry. Just lay down there.
While
you
leaf through that,
Do that. I don't want to disturb you. Here is your papers you've all filled out.
Oh, that's right.
In the yearbook, right?
Yeah, you sent me that.
Uh-huh. And you got part of it filled out, place of birth and everything. And then there's a few other questions. Maybe you already
filled out some of them. Well, it said if they didn't apply to you, don't fill them out.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, right. Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, okay. I see. This is good. Scribe near about 10,000 money. Oh, yeah, this looks good. And I might have some follow-up questions. If it'd be okay to call you sometime and ask you certain things. Because you got everything. Yeah, okay, you talk about how you gained employment and what the training and those kind of things. Okay, that's great. And gain civic action. Okay. Yeah, here's one. Did you correspond with relatives? Your relatives?
My
like
mother.
Your family? With your mother? And how did you do that? By letter?
Letter.
Uh-huh. How often did you write?
I don't know. I think fairly frequently.
Uh-huh. And was she supportive of your efforts, of what you were doing?
Yeah, I think so. She would rather I weren't there, but...
Exactly.
Yeah.
She said, what'd you say when you said you were going to do that?
Oh, I don't know. She was not happy, but...
She thought you should do something else, huh? But, you know, there was... Okay. Half of my friends were protesting.
Were they?
The war in Vietnam.
Really?
And some of them were, of course, the guys joined the Air National Guard or the Guard, some kind of guard units too, so they wouldn't have to go. And I don't remember having any direct friends, but some went to Canada to escape the draft. But I knew people that did that.
Were you a student at K-State?
Yeah, Kansas State University. I was a student.
When you did you go to in the military right out of?
Yeah, right after I graduated, I joined the Army.
Did you?
Uh-huh.
Where'd they send you?
I went to Fort... where did I go? Fort Bragg.
North Carolina.
Yeah, first they sent me, you know, I'm from Kansas, and first they sent me to Fort Knox, and then they said after we were there a couple of days, they said, oh, things have changed. Your group's going to Fort Bragg. We got on a bus, we went to Fort Bragg, did basic training in these old Army barracks from World War II. We had to renovate them and clean them out, kick the dirt and dust and sand out, fire up the boilers.
What year was this?
That was 1966. I graduated in 66. And so then I went in the end of 66, I guess. Yeah, the end of 66. Yeah, the end of 66, and then I was in basic training, and I came home, basic training of Christmas, and then I got sick, and went back, and then 67, I guess I was in what they call Advanced Individual Training, AIT, for armor. I chose armor when I went in. I wanted to be in armor, I said. They asked me, so, well, what do you want to do in the military? You know, would you like to go into logistics? Would you like to be, you know, I said, what are you talking about? I want to join the Army, you know, where you shoot things and shoot guns and do stuff and, oh, you want to be in the combat arms. You don't want to be in a Sigma Corps logistics or anything. I said, yeah, combat arms. And so, well, what do you got? You know, and they said, which one do you want to be in? I said, what do you got? I said, well, in the infantry. I said, well, you know, foxholes and stuff like that. I didn't want to do that. I said, what about artillery? Shoot, long way. I don't know. What about armor? I said, armor, what's that? Oh, tanks. Oh, yeah.
Tanks.
Yeah, tanks. That's all. I'll be in tanks. I could do that. I know how to drive combines and stuff. And I like cars.
Uh-huh.
I like shooting things. Big noises. That'll be fun. So I went to Armor AIT, Advanced Individual Training, for 2 months. And then I had enlisted to go to Officer Candidate School, OCS. And that was also 6 months in Armor at that time at Fort Knox. So I had ten months. And the 6 months was in Officer Candidate School. Well, I got in really good shape. A lot of running and reading and OCS was great training. We learned all kinds of things, you know, how to read maps, calling artillery, how to be in charge, how to take apart machine guns, how to be in tanks and get them all online and navigate and read your terrain maps and the elevation and all that.
Really?
It was very interesting, yeah. And then, of course, we had to do a lot of marching and a lot of calisthenics and a lot of running. And clean our barracks with, you know, very clean and keep everything spit polished and all that kind of stuff. So it was good training. But then during that, I got a chance to apply for flight school and I passed the vision test. And then I had become a second lieutenant by then. And then I went to flight school and that was 9 months in length. And by then I was an officer and I was on TDY, so I stayed in hotel
for 9 months?
No, for 4.5 months. When I went to Fort Rucker, I got a trailer with a buddy and we lived in a trailer. But we could live off post, right? And then I went to Vietnam.
You went from the hotel and the trailer to Vietnam.
Yeah.
That was shocking. So where did you learn how to fly a helicopter?
There in flight school.
Where was that at?
Fort Walters, Alabama. Fort Walters, Texas, near Mineral Wells, which was just west of Fort Worth and Dallas. 4.5 months there. I drove down from Kansas. I'd been on leave. I drove down there in my little Volkswagen. And then 4.5 months later, after we soloed, you know, you learned to fly a helicopter all by yourself. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And then we went on to Fort Rucker for 4.5 more months, transitioned into Huey helicopter, the helicopter that was used in Vietnam all the time. And then after that, you had 30 days leave and then went to Vietnam via San Francisco. I went to San Francisco. I had some fraternity buddies out there that said, come on out. And we had 1 week of partying. And they lined me up with a nice girl and we all had fun and went around the Golden Gate Bridge and had picnics and drank wine and had a great time. Mm-hmm. And that memory of that stood me in good stead in Vietnam. I always remembered, I thought, when I get through this, I'm going back to San Francisco and I'm going to have a good time again. I'm going back to see those nice American women. That was a good goal. That was a big goal of mine, to get back, see those American women.
I remember I wasn't in a helicopter very often, but a couple of times.
No, you were.
Oh, yeah. You can't hardly be there without winding up in one. And I just remember those helicopter pilots looked like teenagers to me.
They were.
And I thought, what we have here are the hot rod enthusiasts right out of high school.
You're right.
That was it. I mean, and they drove them like they were hot rods.
That's right.
But you know, and you know, but they were fearless and they were good. They could do it and set it down wherever it wanted to go. They wanted it to go.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. The typical pilot I found out was like usually a college dropout. Went out of high school, went to college. College is not for me, you know. And, hey, did you ever hear about flying in the U.S. Army? No. Well, you can join up, fly helicopters. You can become a warrant officer. Oh, really? Uh-huh. A lot of guys signed up. You know, you had to pass all the qualifications. You had to have the vision and the health and mental, and you had to take tests and do all that. But all helicopter pilots were volunteers. There was no draftees. So you had a whole different caliber of people within the Army you had lots of draftees. But in aviation, in Army aviation, everybody volunteered. That was a whole different group of people. Said, I want to do this. Now, they said they wanted to do that, but after they got there, they said, what? What do I got myself into? Some of them did.
Were most of your pilots warrant officers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most pilots were warrant officers. And you had 8 helicopters, and we had, in my platoon, an aviation platoon was a little different than an infantry. You had a major as the company commander, and in an infantry platoon, you had a captain, you know, and in an aviation platoon, in a company, each platoon was led by either a lieutenant or a captain. I was first officer, lieutenant, and then a captain, but I was a platoon leader. I was the gunship platoon leader. We had 8 helicopters and about 30 guys or so of other people, support
and
people.
And you were the commanding officer of that group?
Just of a platoon, right? Yeah. And there's 4 platoons, 3 platoons in a company. So there were 2. So we had, in my platoon, we had me, and then we had another, well, I think we had a couple other guys that were lieutenants. And then everybody else was warrant officers. So we had most
of them. But you had 8 helicopters.
Yeah.
And your job was what?
To fly the helicopters and support the missions.
Did you ferry freight back and forth, or did you pick up?
People and people and supplies. Right. See, our company, the 61st Helicopter Company, we had 2 slick platoons, which was 8 helicopters of the lift helicopters that hauled supplies and troops. They didn't have guns hanging out on them. And then we had 1 of gunships, 8 gunships with mini guns and rockets. And we protected those as they went in and landed and took off. And we supported the 173rd Airborne Troops when they would get in trouble and attack. And then we'd shoot around them and fire around them. That was our
job. So you did have guns on board?
Oh, yeah. We had. We had mini guns on each side that fired 4,000 to 5,000 rounds a minute.
Oh, I thought you said you didn't have guns. You just...
Yeah, we did.
You did?
I did, yeah. Uh-huh.
You had a gunner?
Oh, we had the miniguns on each side that would fire, you know, just a blur of bullets going out. 6 barrels, and they would all fire. And at nighttime, you'd just be a stream of light going out. You'd be like waving light, you know. Those were, each of those, in between each of those tracers was 4 or 5 other bullets. So you were firing 5,000 rounds a minute out of both sides. That's a lot.
Yeah.
It would just rip up jungles and trees and stuff. And then we had rockets on each side, 17 rockets, 2.75 rockets, and you could punch one off at a time. And
so who was flying this helicopter? You?
Yeah.
You were flying the helicopter?
Flying the helicopter, and then you had a co-pilot. And the co-pilot, you would have the minigun, control of the miniguns. Or the co-pilot had control of the miniguns. And you, as the pilot, had control of the rockets, because the rockets were directed by where you pointed the helicopter.
Ah.
You had a kind of sight. So this is old technology, real old technology, right? You had to point the helicopter to where you want the rocket to go. But the miniguns, you had a
joystick
grip on
there.
You
could point it
where. Yeah, you could point those to the left or right. And then in the back, you had a door gunner with an M60 machine gun on a bungee cord. He was firing. And then your crew chief on the other side also had an M60 machine gun on a bungee cord, and he was firing. So you had a significant amount of firepower.
Did you pick up many patients?
Well, as a gunship pilot, that was not the job. But as a slick pilot, I was a slick pilot for 5-6 months, we did pick up wounded people. First, we would haul in like the 173 Airborne to a combat assault, and then if they engaged people and they got wounded, then we would bring them supplies, and if the medevac pilots couldn't handle taking out the wounded, we would also take out wounded.
Medevac, that's right.
We had medevac pilots that they were also stationed with us. And I volunteered to be, I wanted to be, after I was there about 3 months, four or five months, you know, as a slick pilot, a lot of dangerous missions, you know, and that's when I became sort of like, wait a minute. I think I'm becoming, this war deal here is a bunch of young guys running around killing each other, and I don't think this is a very good idea. You know, somebody should have settled this problem earlier. What the hell's going on here? You know, and I sort of thought, you know, hey, wait a minute. This is not right. This is not like in the movies. This is not John Wayne, Alan Ladd. What's just everybody's crying and moaning and griming, and they don't want us here, and we don't want to be there, and I don't get it. I'm not behind this so much. I volunteered to be a medevac pilot. I went to my company commander. I think I've told you this, right? Mm-hmm. I went to my company commander and I said, well, sir, you know, I think I'm not, I'm more philosophically disposed to be a medevac pilot. And he said, well, son, you've been trained to be a combat officer. Our gunship platoon leader has gotten killed. Our assistant gunship platoon leader has gotten killed. I want you to be the new gunship platoon leader. And I said, oh. And I had friends, warrant officers, they said, in the gunships, and they said, yeah, we'd like for you to be the platoon leader for us. Come on. And I said, well, I guess if I don't get a transfer, and I can be the gunship platoon leader, and that's what you wanted me to do, and I'm in the Army, and I'm supposed to follow orders. Okay. So then I was the gunship platoon leader for the next 6 months. And it was easy because all those warrant officers knew what to do. They were well-trained. They could fly the helicopters. They were experienced. They knew their job. And basically, you know, I was the front man for them. Yeah, but I had other jobs too, you know, like building those hooches, writing reports, and doing all kinds of other administrative things. And when there were conflicts, then of course you had to resolve them. And then you also had a whole bunch of enlisted men that were in your platoon, that were the crew chiefs and the door gunners that were you were in charge of. You know, I didn't really sign up for that. I thought I was just going to be a helicopter pilot. That was enough for me. Just flying a helicopter was plenty. But then to be in charge of all this equipment assigned for it, all these other people that sometimes got killed and, you know, they had problems. It was like, okay, I'm sure glad you guys, most of you know what to do, because I really don't. But, you know, this is the kind of thing that in retrospect, I'm so honored that I had the opportunity to do that, and like you and what you did, you know, it's like, wow, what an amazing thing, what an incredible experience that you had, and what you did, and the people you associated with, and what great people they were, and how they were serving their country and doing the best they could. I mean, it's like, holy smoke, this is like top deal in my life. And then to come home and people didn't recognize it, that was very confusing. I thought, oh, I could understand it because I became less pro-Vietnam War.
How did you, I don't want to take you off this. How did you wind up in France?
Oh,
in France, I wanted to go to France. I wanted to go to another culture and learn another language. That was part of my study. I graduated in sociology, you know, and I had taken a little French in college, and I thought I'd always wanted to go to France and learn French better. I thought it'd be fun.
Did you do that right after the military?
Yeah, about a month after.
Really?
Uh-huh. I got out, and I got my ticket, and...
And you went?
Yeah, I went. Because I didn't want to hang around the U.S. Well, I just wanted to do some more traveling. You know, the military is a little disappointing. My experience in Vietnam, you know, like you, I wanted to travel, go to exotic places, meet people, and you know, it's kind of disappointing. You know, you were on a ship for 1 year. I was in Vietnam for 1 year. Where was this travel and meeting people and doing interesting things? You know, it was quite a bit different than what we had projected. Although it was an incredible experience in both cases, it was not what we expected. So I wanted to go on to do some more things. Learn French, live in another culture. I thought it'd be interesting to see where would I fit in another culture if I went in to learn the language. What would it be like?
You were a deep thinker.
Well,
I never had such a deep thought. No.
Well, you wanted to go do something different. What the heck?
That.
You want to travel. Yeah. It was fun. We had good experiences. Well, I'm sure glad you took the time to put all this together and get together and take the time to talk to me. I know it's a big experience, but... I'm going to put it together in a little kind of a way so we can, maybe you can describe that experience a little bit better if you're willing to
do that. Is there anything I can help you to make this any easier now for you?
Well, you've got it all boxed up and ready to go, and I'm going to take it back, and then I think I'll try to take some pictures and put it in some kind of order and align it with what you told me about a little bit so that somebody can, you know, this is not in scrapbook form. It'd be nice if it were in like scrapbook form or some kind of presentation to show when you started, kind of what happened along the way, and then a little comment on that or something like that. I don't know. Actually, that's what I'd like to do, whether I'll do that or not. I'd like to see them do it.
When you got a hold of the guy this time in Texas,
yeah.
Is that the guy that did the oral history with you originally?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you have a relationship with him.
Yeah.
And what's his, is he the director of?
Yeah, the Vietnam Archives. He's the director of the Oral History Project, who authorized me to do this, and I'll send that to him. There is another director of the archives and the material, and that is where we need to sign this paper, the deed of gift, and we'll send it to him.
So all
your materials
are
going, they're all going to the Vietnam Archives, but one department has the materials, and another department has the oral history type part.
Have we basically done an oral history?
Yeah, we just did.
Okay,
yeah, good. But we might have to do some follow-up. We might have to do some follow-up if I have some questions about some of these pictures. I'd like to put them in a little bit of an order so that I can show them to my guys in my unit, 61st Assault Helicopter Company, that we have our reunions every year, and we like to see what different people have done. You know, we've told our stories to each other too many times, mm-hmm. right? And so we have this Libraries of Vietnam project, so we like to
talk about that. What have we done since then? And what are other people's? We invite, you know, you're welcome to come to our reunion. It's September 9th in Iowa. We'd love to have you, right? They'd love to have you. And anybody's welcome who's interested in Vietnam and been there. And so we have a guy from the band Kansas, famous band, come and play for us. And he was a member at one time. And we're going to have, this year, we're going to have the photographer. You know, the famous picture of the girl running down the highway with no clothes on, and she'd been napalmed by the South Vietnamese Air Force by mistake. The guy that took that picture is going to talk to us. That girl was going to come, but she now lives in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And she has two kids, and she's got a nice, you know, life.
I've seen her. She did a couple interviews on TV sometime in the last year and a half.
Oh, you've seen her.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and she's very nice and very well-spoken. And
I actually haven't seen those.
Yeah, she...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, she's going to start a library through our Libraries of Vietnam project.
How's that going?
That's going good.
Is it?
Yeah. There are...
So is that something you can look up, or...?
Yeah, you can look it up online. Libraries of Vietnam project. And it's called Children's Libraries of Vietnam now. CLI.
But we'll look it up here. This has a goodie bag in it if you want it, or you don't have to.
Yeah.
You can put that in there.
Okay.
And I still need a piece of paper. Let's see.
You have to sign these papers here.
Oh.
To authorize the museum to take those. Andrew is the name of the fellow that's in charge of that part.
Have you ever met him, actually?
No. Good guys, though. I've just talked to him.
It sounded like they're basically almost overwhelmed with stuff.
Well, I think their funding is... if they had more funding, they could do better. They're understaffed. And yeah, you know, you're right, overwhelmed. This fellow that this document is going to is Andrew Hinton. And, you know, he has written.
He has what?
He has, I think maybe I forwarded his emails to you, did I?
I think you did.
Yeah. And so, his title here. So he's in charge of the archives, the memorabilia, and Kelly Krager, Dr. Krager, is in charge of the oral history. So as I put some of these things together, I'm going to ask you for a little bit more as far as the I'll try to put them together in some sort of continuity. Yeah, that's the only page you need to sign, but you can read you can read the other pages. It tells you what.
No, it's okay.
It tells you what it's all about. Explanatory pages, where it's going.
There's nothing. I'm more than happy to sign off on all of it.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. The military doesn't do any of this kind of thing.
Well, you know, it's outside the military's purview. You know, once you serve, then...
they're not.
That's what the American Legion is about, you know. I mean, I thought the American Legion at first, I didn't know. I thought it was like a government thing.
Like a what?
Like some kind of government organization. I didn't know. But, it, you know, the American Legion was started to take care of veterans. They realized that once the war was over, the Army said, see ya. And other than that, that's how Veterans Administration, hospitals got started for veterans in the GI Bill, right? The GI Bill is the big deal that was started by American Legion and the VFW veterans organizations.
Okay.
So that didn't come out of the government by itself. They started it in 1919 at the end of World War One in France. Is how the American Legion got started. And those veterans right away, they realized that, wait a minute, we need some veterans organizations. What are we going to do after this is over? They just dump you out. And so, you know, Texas Tech University has this project where they know that it's important that we record the history of people that have been in these military conflicts and we learn from it. And so that's all about this history project, the oral history, and the
so they're the not archives. Just Vietnam, they're...
This particular section is Vietnam. And there are other Vietnam veteran organizations. There's a helicopter pilots organization in Fort Walters, Texas, Mineral mm-hmm. Wells now. But those are all private organizations. Mm-hmm. And like this is a university, but it's a Texas Tech is a, well, a Texas college. They're basically private now, you know, universities.
Really?
I mean, they say, yeah, universities are funded by tuition now. They're very expensive to go to school.
Texas Tech?
Yeah, any school to go to, you know,
oh,
like
I know.
Like Ohio State's supposed to be a state university, right? What does it cost to go there? $1 trillion now.
How much?
I don't know, but a lot, yeah, right? Yeah. And when you went there, and when I went to Kansas State University, it cost about less than $100 for a semester, for as many hours as I wanted to take. The state paid for 85% of the funding of the college, and the student paid for like 15%. Well, now that's reversed, and the students or organizations that are paying for research done by the institute, by the university, they provide about 85% of the funding for a state university, and only 15% is student tuition anymore, something like that. So universities have become, instead of public universities, in a way you could say they're now private schools, sort of. You know, they're funded differently. Like in a private school, you went to a private school and you had to pay tuition, pretty good tuition, to go to a private college. And so state universities are like that now. They're expensive to go to. Okay, well, let's see. We're going to say as we sign off here that we're still going to do a little ongoing research into what we've discovered here, which is pretty remarkable. And once again, it's August 8th, did we say? August 8th, 2021, and I'm with Meredith Beck. It was Meredith...
it's August 9th.
August 9th,
yes.
2021. And your maiden name, Meredith? Was
Klaus.
Klaus. Meredith Klaus. And you served as the hospital director aboard the...
It was American Red Cross Hospital Field Director aboard the USS Hospital Ship Repose in Vietnam, October 1968. To October 1969.
All right, thank you. And I'm Ken Embers. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I was a helicopter pilot, and I served in Vietnam from October 1968 to October 1969. And Meredith and I have become friends through a mutual friend. Her good friend was Pat Van Atta, who I met later in life and married, and that is now my wife. And so we're getting together to look through her memorabilia and her remembrances from Vietnam. And I am the first person she's ever shown these materials to, because, as we know, not too many people were interested in Vietnam veterans and service personnel at the end of the war. So it's a privilege and an honor to be here, and we'll continue on with this at a later date. Thank you. Goodbye.
No.
Is that what it is? Yeah. Okay.
Oh, that won't... okay. And now we'll hear both phones. Okay. All right, Meredith, I think we've got it set up now so that we can hear both of us.
Okay, good. Okay.
And we're recording.
Okay.
Okay, so let's see here. This is Ken Embers, and I'm doing an interview with Meredith Beck. I'm doing this for the Vietnam Oral History Project, authorized by Dr. Kelly Krager. He said to go ahead and do the interview with Meredith, and I was I'm a Vietnam veteran myself, and I'm talking with Meredith Beck. And Meredith, would you tell me, let's see, you are in where are you located now? Okay, in Port Clinton, Ohio, and you were born there, and I'm going to go over your, this is the wartime civilian questionnaire with you that you have already filled out, but I would like to record your answers so that we can have it sent in on this recording to the Oral History Project. So... can you tell me what you did during the period when you were in Vietnam, and what you were there for, what you were doing?
I worked for the American National Red Cross. I was a civilian. I was assigned to the Navy hospital ship, the USS Repose, as the hospital field director, which was a Red Cross function in a military hospital. And there were several components to that job, but the biggest part of it was to facilitate communication between servicemen and their families at home via teletype machine, or via Navy type communication.
Okay.
And letters. Written communication and teletype machine. Okay.
Yeah, and then that period, that was October 1968 to October 69, right?
Correct.
And you were on that ship off the coast of Vietnam in the Da Nang area?
Right. We were, we went back and forth, up and down the coast. We went up as far as the demilitarized zone, or not, I don't know if that's what you called it.
Yeah, the DMZ, yeah. Right? I wondered about that. I was going to ask you how far north you went.
I don't remember. Anyway, it wasn't demilitarized, it was the dividing.
Oh yeah, yeah, you're right.
Between North and South Korea, or Vietnam.
We went
up that far, and then down as far as Da Nang. So that was.
Okay. Yeah.
I think that was called I Corps, but I'm not sure.
You're right. You're right. I Corps was okay. There, and when I Corps ended, that's when North Vietnam started. So you were in the northernmost part of South Vietnam.
Correct. And we were about. I read this somewhere else. We were about 3 miles off the coast.
Ah.
And we would just go up and down and up and down so slowly you could hardly discern movement. But and we would do that for about 3 days, and we were obviously just sitting out there to take on patients, casualties, or patients onto the hospital ship. And then at the end of the 3 days, we would go down to Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
And anchor in that harbor, and then they would replenish the supplies on the ship, bring on the mail, you know, and they would take off. Oh dear, don't do that again. Okay, they would take off the patients that were going on to other hospitals, mostly in Japan.
Oh.
So, yeah, and then we would be there maybe over 3 days to do that. Uh-huh. There was another hospital ship that was identical called the Sanctuary, and we just alternated with them. When we were in Da Nang, they were up on station, as they called it.
Yeah.
And then they came down and we went up. So we were just, you know,
I see.
A little team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wondered how that worked. I'm glad you explained that to me. I want to go back a little bit, following along this outline. You had to qualify for your position. How did you? What was your prior education?
You needed to be a college graduate and with some social work background, if you. Mm-hmm. Had it, and you had to be single. I mean, they could require that at that point, but I don't think they could do that now, but then you could, and so that's pretty much the requirements. And then normally before you would go overseas like that, where you wouldn't have much of a supporting team or whatever, you would spend a couple years in the States in a military hospital under supervision and learn the job, basically. And so then, if you were interested, you could apply to go overseas.
Ah, okay. And so after college, you went to, let's see here, it says you went to Colby College and graduated, and then you decided that you wanted to try to do this?
Well, I worked for the welfare department in Cleveland, Ohio for two years.
Yeah, okay.
Uh-huh.
All right. And, okay, and so then you volunteered to do that, but you got paid to do that, right? And you worked for the American National Red Cross. Let's see. You mentioned. Here's the question: what kind of training did you receive upon being hired? Is that where you went to?
You know, honestly, Ken, I can't remember specifically.
Okay.
I think it was mostly on-the-job training.
Okay.
I don't believe there was any formalized, training program at all. It was mostly on-the-job.
Okay, and what was that job? What were you doing before you went to Vietnam?
I was at the military hospital in Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Oh, okay, and how long were you there?
It felt like forever, but it wasn't. I think maybe 2 years.
Okay.
I think maybe three.
And when I joined the Army, I thought travel to exotic places would be a lot of fun and meet new people and go to different cultures. And you mentioned to me once that you also were attracted by that when you joined the Army.
Well, I think... It was that we were in this war.
Yeah.
And, you know, you sort of wanted to know about it.
Yeah.
Or you wanted to help, I think, is what you wanted to do.
Exactly. And, exactly.
So that was primarily it. I don't, I never saw it as a way to travel to a foreign country at that point. I think in later years, I had friends that were stationed in very great, you know, in Germany and, you know, wherever there were military hospitals, that would be a possible assignment. So
okay. And so you were at Fort Dix for a couple of years, and then did you volunteer to go to Vietnam?
Yes.
And what made you want to do that? You wanted to serve, and you knew there was a need there?
Yeah, right.
Okay. And the next question here is, what did you think and how did you feel when you learned you were going to Vietnam? And what did members of your family think?
Well, I never imagined that I would be in any danger. I mean, I never felt like a soldier going to war. Now that would be a whole nother thing.
Yeah, but
I never felt that way. I knew that I was going to a hospital, and that, you know, it was not a dangerous assignment, really.
Well,
and because actually then, oddly, we still had rules of war.
Yeah.
And they didn't bomb hospitals, and we didn't. You know, so it was a bit different then. There are no rules anymore, obviously, but...
Well, there were rules then, but they weren't always followed, and there were a hospital. Did you know you would be on a ship, or did you think you were going to be in a hospital in Vietnam, on land?
No, I knew I'd be on this particular ship.
Okay, okay. Uh-huh. So that seemed relatively safe, according to the Geneva Convention. Those rules were that they wouldn't bomb or attack or a hospital ship. But anyway, those rules weren't always followed. So that was actually a pretty dangerous position. But what did your family members think?
Well, there was just my mother, and she, I don't know what, well, I do, she just would much prefer that I didn't go.
Yeah.
She didn't see any reason for me to go off doing that, but I think she was okay. I mean,
okay,
as she could be. I sadly didn't pay much attention, you know, to her. Protestations.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
And maybe she didn't protest too much because, you know, in the tradition of American tradition was that you served during wars, and although the mothers never like to see their progeny do that, it seemed like the right thing to do.
Yeah, and you know, I do believe too that my mother was aware that this was not a dangerous assignment per se. You know, this was not like being a foot soldier.
Oh.
I mean, there was nothing like that, and I think she knew. You know.
Okay, so the answer to this question is, did you ever encounter enemy forces while serving in Southeast Asia and Vietnam?
No. Uh-uh.
Yeah, okay. And let's me go on to another question. Did you ever engage in any kind of civic action in Vietnam? For example, did you or your unit help with civilian construction progress, well, irrigation, or what kind of civic action would you say you were involved in?
None. I mean, we weren't on hand.
Okay. Well, on this questionnaire that you filled out for Texas Tech, the project, you said you had some Vietnamese children on board. Can you tell me about that?
We did. And they were part of a program, a people-to-people program, which at the time I didn't know much about at all. I mean, and I didn't have any role to play with those children. That was the hospital, that was the hospital that took care of those children. I think they had a special place on board for them.
Mm-hmm.
The nurses certainly took care of them. We actually did have a baby born on board.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yes, and that was much anticipated, and it was on the PA system when the baby was born.
Right.
But those children came on board, and I'm not sure what for. I don't think anything terribly serious. I don't think they did, but I don't know that for sure. I mean, I don't think they did surgery on, I think it was maybe cuts and bruises and broken bones, maybe things like that.
Well, they could have been separated from their family with nowhere to go, who knows, or maybe...
Right, and somebody would have brought them out there, and until they got an interpreter to sort it out,
There's a really nice...
We did have children on board, and they kind of were free to sort of run around the ship.
Oh, I bet that was nice.
And there are a couple pictures I can remember of them playing checkers or something with some of the patients. They were cute.
Yeah, well,
cute kids.
Yeah, there's a real nice picture of you holding one of them, and that looks like that kid is really happy.
A little girl, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. That's great, and we know more about the people-to-people program now, and in fact, President Eisenhower started that program, and his granddaughter was the head of the people-to-people program, which I got to meet her in Kansas City not too terribly long ago.
Oh, really?
A few years ago, yeah. She worked with our Libraries of Vietnam project. And that people-to-people program started by Eisenhower was very interesting because, he was a great general and everything, but he thought that if we had programs like the people-to-people program, perhaps that would help avoid wars and would promote communication between countries, which, I think was a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's see, you had, did you have much contact with the indigenous population?
No.
Okay. And, but a little bit, but you did go, on land, sometimes, right?
Not very often.
Okay. Here's one. Could you describe your first impressions of Southeast Asia? And you answered this question about, I remember landing at Da Nang. What happened there when you were first going to Southeast Asia, to Vietnam?
My first impression was when we got off the plane, we went into, I think it must have been a hangar or
a terminal.
But anyway, and it was big and a big empty space, and all on the floor were these GIs sleeping on the floor, and they were all holding or cradling their guns, their rifles.
Yeah,
and it was just a picture I would never have sort of. Yeah. I mean, it was just kind of shocking, really.
Hey, wait a minute. These people have got weapons.
Right. This must be a war. I mean, I must have landed in a war zone here.
This is the real deal now. And right. To say that that this was you were not in any danger at all is kind of an understatement, because where you were then, those people got mortared and they got rocket attacks and all kinds of things happened there at that Da Nang air base. So
did it really?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Well,
maybe not while you were there, but
no.
But it often happened there. That happened there. So you were in a war zone, definitely. Let's see. This I don't know how this follows, but what did you do for recreation while you were aboard ship?
For what, dear?
For recreation. This is the question number 28. What'd you do for recreation? Yeah, you're plenty busy.
I don't think that ever came up. I don't know. There was always something that needed to be done or something to do.
Okay.
But I don't really remember.
Okay. Take your time. Yeah, that's just, you know, one of the questions on here.
Oh dear.
Have a sip of water or coffee or whatever you need. Let's see.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. It says next. Could you? You've got an answer in here, but it says. Describe your living conditions aboard the ship.
Well, there was a nurse's quarters. There were about 31, I think, about that, nurses, Navy nurses on the ship. And then the two Red Cross, there were two Red Cross people.
Uh-huh.
The other Red Cross person was a recreation director.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a nurse's quarters, and it was a section that had a separate entrance, and it was just a section that was, you know, set off for nurses in it. So there were little compartments, and you had a set of bunk beds, I'm pretty sure that the bathroom facilities were communal. I don't think we had our own at all.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty much it. It wasn't any great, thing.
Okay.
It was adequate, I guess.
Yeah, definitely adequate. Could you describe the most memorable experience from daily life in Southeast Asia? Do you remember what you answered on that? Describe the most memorable experience. You mentioned to this day the sound of a helicopter.
The most memorable
experience from your daily life on board ship.
From my daily life?
Yeah. You responded to that question. It says, to this day, the sound of a helicopter coming closer from a distance. A very unique sound I've never forgotten. So,
yes, and I'm sure a lot of people have that same experience, you know.
When you heard a helicopter coming, you knew you were going to get probably wounded and things were going to happen.
Yes, or mail, or
yeah,
something was coming. Yes,
right. Yeah. That's good. Yeah, you mentioned to me one time about flying in helicopters with those young pilots and. You had a couple statements. Could you say something about what you thought about those guys that were flying those helicopters and what they were doing?
Well, when we got to Da Nang, then we had to get out to the ship, mm-hmm. which was in the Da Nang Harbor at that time. And, you know, I didn't know anything about any of this, but, you know, fortunately there were people that knew we had to get out there, helicopter, and that's how we got out to the ship. And when I looked at the guy flying the helicopter, he looked to be about 18 years old, and I thought, oh my God, these are kids. These are just kids. And, I thought, you know, they're driving this helicopter like they would drive their little souped up car at home, you know. I mean, they would take off, the nose would be down, you know. I mean, it was just, they were having fun.
and
I thought, oh my God, they must love this job.
And you mentioned something about them flying those helicopters like they were hot rods.
Yeah, that's just what I thought. I thought, he's just like, he's at home with his car, you know. Yeah, only better.
Yeah, only better. Yeah, it would fly. And then you told me something about they could fly them most anywhere. Make them go wherever they wanted to, and land most anywhere.
Did you have those young guys in your unit?
Oh, yeah. You know,
So you know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, I was a college graduate, and I was the gunship platoon leader, so I was like an old guy.
I'm sure you were.
And the only guy older than me was the company commander. He was a major. But, you know, I was maybe 25, 26, a lot of helicopter pilots were right after high school. I'd say the typical helicopter pilot went to college in 1 or 2 years, decided college wasn't for them, and at that time there was a draft, but if you joined the Army, then you could choose. And when you went to enlist, when somebody said, oh, well, maybe you'd like to fly helicopters, you know, guys went, oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, fly helicopters. I could fly helicopters. And said, well, yeah, you have to pass this battery of tests, and you have to qualify, and you have to have 20/20 vision, and you have to have all these requirements, but... yeah, you could do that. And so lots of people went through warrant officer school. And they became a warrant officer after about 9 or 10 months, but they also got their wings. I went through officer candidate school for 6 months, you know, basic training and AIT and officer candidate school for 6 months. And then when I went to flight school, I was a second lieutenant already. So I lived off post hotel, but most helicopter pilots were warrant officers, and they always lived on base, and they learned about being a warrant officer at the same time they were going to flight school, so it was a quite intensive program for them. But you're right, the age was like 19, 20 years old, and you know, those guys were they were fearless, you know.
Yes, exactly.
They were invincible, and it was like, well, nothing's going to happen to me. And I noticed that, and I said, I'm just old enough to be pretty leery of this thing, and I see there's a lot of danger involved in this job. And I thought, man, these guys, they're going right after it. This is fun. Yeah, you're right.
I know.
Okay. The one question that is in here that you left blank was, and maybe there's something you might mention now. It says, describe the most humorous experience from your daily life in Vietnam. You left that one blank.
I put probably couldn't remember a humorous experience.
I know.
There had to have been one. I mean, I know, you know, sailors are a very interesting breed, and they are they're fun. They can be fun, and
yeah,
I don't know what to say about that, but they're
able to make their own fun somehow.
Yes, and I don't know. They're
yeah,
but I don't remember
any particular instance. Yeah,
a funny thing, or I'm sure there were some, but
yeah. Yeah.
I don't remember back that far.
Somebody asked me that question too last year, and I said I can't think of anything funny. I can just remember some kind of sick humor that in retrospect was pretty funny. Like I think I mentioned to you the time that when I was new there, and I was on the standby mission. It was the middle of the night, and for the first time, our number was called, like, standby. You know, you got a mission. These guys are surrounded. You got to go out in the middle of the night and pick them up. Embers, get out there. And, you know, and I was, of course, a co-pilot at that time, but I got all my gear together, my helmet and everything, and my maps, and I thought, oh, my God, we're going to go out in the middle of the night in this jungle and go down on the ground and pick up these guys that are being shot at and bring them back, a LERP team. And as I'm very nervous, you know, and I'm getting ready to leave this little hooch, and here's some other guys over there, and they're listening to a tape deck. And the tape deck is playing Simon and Garfunkel's Like a Bridge Over Troubled Waters. And I'm listening to that, and I'm thinking, God, I wish I was back in the United States hanging out with some hippies or something, you know. And as I go out the door, another guy in the back says, we had these fans, and we had electricity most of the time, but not all the time. But if you did have electricity and you had a fan, that was really great. So as I'm going out the door, this guy says, he knew I was a new guy, and I was pretty anxious about this. And he hollers at me and says, hey, Embers, if you don't come back, can I have your fan? You know, I just kind of turned white at the time, but in retrospect, it's pretty funny.
Well, that's the kind of humor. That's it.
Yeah.
There's no great show of compassion or, you know, anything. It's just...
Right.
Yeah. I know. You know, the music was interesting. You said that we had the Bridge Over Trouble. There was the music of the war, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And sailors in the Navy often are somehow Southern. I don't know what that is. I mean, I don't know why so many of them.
Uh-huh.
Are from, you know, Arkansas or the Carolinas or the Appalachians. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
But they're country, and so their music is country music.
Uh-huh.
And that was the day or the era of the reel-to-reel tape deck.
Oh, yeah.
And there were hundreds of those on the ship.
Yeah.
We did not have a problem with with power. So... they would play this all over the ship, would be this country music.
Uh-huh.
And I had never heard of Waylon Jennings. I had never heard of, you know, any of these people. But
yeah,
I certainly got acclimated to them. And, oh, my. And, you know, goodness sake.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's the same way in the... well, like in the Army, and you're talking about the Navy, lots of people in the Army were from the southeast part of the United States. For one thing, you know, it's a good job compared to some other jobs that maybe weren't available. And they have a long tradition of being soldiers in that part of the country, and a proud tradition. Let's see. On another note, what about? Do you remember any type of discrimination or racial tension among personnel on board the ship?
I do not.
Okay.
No.
Uh huh. And did you have very many minority groups? Did you have very many blacks or Filipino or other?
We did not have a lot of blacks. There were some black sailors, but not a lot.
Okay. Yeah.
And but of course, in the Navy, the mess people, the meat people that take care of the mess, the officers' mess, are always Filipino. That's a Navy job description for Filipino.
Right.
I mean, that's where they pretty much keep them, is in the, I mean, the Navy in that day and age was extremely discriminatory. I mean,
even I
in that day and age couldn't imagine how they got away with that, you know?
Yeah.
But, so we did have a lot of Filipinos. I don't mean a lot, but we had enough. I mean, 20, 25.
Yeah.
And they did all of the food, everything for the officers' mess.
Okay. Yeah.
Which was a completely different experience than anything you had, I will guarantee you. Because we had white tablecloths and people were dressed for dinner. And and your meal was served to you. You know, by a Filipino.
Yes, one of the we call them food service people now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they would come around with the platter, and you would have to get your food off that platter and put it on your plate, and then he would go on to the next person. I mean, and I never ceased to be amazed that we would be in the middle of a war zone and we're still doing this.
That was the nice part about the Navy.
What?
That was the nice part about the Navy.
They got away with it. I don't know how they did it, but they did it.
Well, they could do it, and they were able to do it. And, you know, the pilots or the other people that were on board those ships, you know, it was always, even where I was in helicopters, you know, we had a mess tent, but we certainly didn't have any kind of tablecloths or anything like that. And the infantry guys, of course, that were out in the field were eating LERPs and C rations and K rations and things like that. So that was quite different.
We occasionally had officers that came on board as patients who were not maybe particularly, they might have come on board because they had an infected tooth or something. We had a dentist and, or, you know, something not major. So they would then eat in the officer's mess, and they were flabbergasted.
I'll bet they were. Yeah, I'll bet they were. They Marines.
Yeah.
Yeah, Marines like, that had been out in the field.
Oh, my God. He says, I've died and went to heaven here, you know.
Yeah. What is it, the juxtaposition of that is if you were on board a Navy ship and you were a Navy pilot, is that for one period of time, you could be eating like that and white tablecloths and silverware and people serving you. And 15 minutes later, you could be flying over the jungles in Vietnam and people shooting at you, you know. And it's like we had somewhat of that experience. I noticed as a helicopter pilot, we would be sitting in our chairs, in our lounge chairs, sitting around outside just talking, smoking cigarettes, and then get a scramble mission. And then within a few minutes, we would be in combat. And I thought, my God, just a half hour ago, I was sitting in a relative safety. And, and now, all of a sudden, it's not safe anymore. People are shooting at me. And that was quite a change. Did members did were the, was there a problem with or did people use alcohol and or drugs, and if so, what was most popular?
You know, I'm not. I cannot say they did not, but I was not aware of it.
Uh-huh.
And I would probably have been about the last person to be aware of it.
Okay.
You know, mm-hmm. I mean,
well,
no one would confide that in me, I don't think.
Yeah. Well, you were an officer, and usually that...
Yeah, and I wasn't even military.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wouldn't have known, really. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah.
I don't think so, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it certainly didn't impair any of the work that had to be done.
Yeah, right. And let's see, did we say what year was this? You were, what year was this?
68, 69.
Yeah, okay. And I remember people, when I was there during that same period, there were people using drugs, and everybody drank. We all drank alcohol, but a few people used marijuana and other stuff. But they were mainly, those were enlisted guys, and they always avoided. Yeah, you're there?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an incoming call on my phone, sorry.
Oh, okay.
And I had to get rid of it. Okay, so anyway, it wasn't a problem, but I understand that later on in after 69, I had friends that went back for a second tour, and they said the drug use became increasingly heavy, and it was sometimes a problem. But
I believe that.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Let's see, here's a song. Name the song or music that most reminds you of Vietnam or did you ever see or participate in a USO show? And if so, when and where and who hosted it? Did you ever have USO shows?
I'm sure they did. I never saw one. I've seen pictures, though.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can remember that there were USO girls on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of what they did, they might not have done a show, but they probably visited hospital patients. You know, they'd go through the wards, I think, and you know how they do, and say hi and whatever.
Yeah. Okay.
Which was,
Yeah, it was that was a boost. That was a morale booster.
Right. I think that's more what they did, not put on. There wouldn't be a venue for a big USO show.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
Did you correspond with relatives and friends back in the U.S. while you were aboard ship? And if you did, how?
Well, mostly with my mother by letter.
Mm-hmm. While I was there, we one time had this opportunity to go to a place, and we got to call home by radio.
Right.
And did you ever do that?
Yeah, and we had a radio operator on board, and that was his job, was to they called it patching.
Yeah, that's it.
Calls through, and I think you had to sign up for that, and you know, he gave you a time, and you sort of got your family primed for it, so they would be home, and
We did that once, and I remember my parents were actually at home when they called, and we talked to them, and it was really, really quite interesting. But letters was the way we corresponded back and forth, which is quite different than the way they do it now, right? they talk daily to their family. A lot of people do that were in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Uh-huh.
Okay, we're getting here towards the end of some things here. It says, what did you think and feel about your experiences in Vietnam upon leaving?
Oh, I don't...
I'll give you... He says... I'll read what you wrote. Do you want me to do that?
Okay.
It says, by the time I left, I remember having no doubt that the war was an exercise in futility. A very bad decision on the part of the government. By then, there were anti-war demonstrations, and I thought they were right to do it.
Did I say that?
You did.
Oh.
And I like that statement because I thought the same thing when I was there. I thought, oh, wait a minute, there's something's wrong here. This is not set up right. And I had the feeling that the Vietnamese would just wish that they wished that we'd go home. They wished the North Vietnamese would go back to North Vietnam, and they wished that we'd go back to America and everybody just leave them alone. So that's what you wrote. And the next question is, have those feelings changed since you left? If so, how and why? Yeah, okay. All right, they haven't changed. And you wrote here, no, they have become more... I can't quite get that real word there. They become more I don't know what that is.
I don't either.
Yeah, okay. I think more, they become more, I believe it even more. For a long time, I had a plaque on my bulletin board that said, war is not healthy for children and other living things. You wrote that.
I did. Uh-huh. Are you saying you did too, or I?
No,
I did.
That's what you wrote. Yeah.
Oh, really? Uh-huh. Yes.
And so.
And I mean, for years I kept that up.
Yeah.
And I've still got it.
Yeah, really good.
It's true.
It is true. I agree with you, and I think so too. How were you received upon your return to the United States?
Well, I just was assigned to another hospital job.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't any big deal. I mean,
okay.
It was just a job, you know, and so...
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, so many Vietnam veterans were called bad names, baby killers, and spit on, and... But you were not in that environment because you were with the National Red Cross, American Red Cross, and that didn't happen to you. Is that right?
It did not. No.
Okay. Have you ever visited the Vietnam War memorials in Washington D.C. or the Traveling Walls?
Have I ever what?
Visited the Vietnam War Memorial. Washington, D.C.
Yeah, the one in Washington, I
uh-huh.
did.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And did you know anybody on that wall?
No, and I looked up two people that I had always wondered about, and neither were on there. There's mm-hmm. a book, you know, that has all the names right. in alphabetical order.
Mm-hmm.
So you can... you know, look it up. And they were neither one of them there, and I was relieved to know that.
Okay. What do you think and feel about U.S. participation in the Vietnam War?
I think it was a huge mistake.
Okay. Yeah. You said, what a mistake that has left a trail of sorrow and pain, almost unconscionable. Yeah, I agree with you there. Do you think the goals and aims of the U.S. and Southeast Asia justified the cost of the wars?
Do I think what?
What? The goals and aims of the U.S. in Vietnam justified the costs of the war?
Oh, 11 snow.
Right. I didn't think so. And I like this answer. What about this question? What do you think about American post-war policy toward Southeast Asia, toward Vietnam?
Well, I don't see that they have a post-war policy, and I think that's good.
Okay.
They don't need a post-war policy. Okay. I think they're doing pretty well on their own.
Yeah, I think so, too. You know, I have these classes, and I meet with the Vietnamese people twice a week, and we talk about what they're doing, and they seem to be doing pretty well. Really, and
you know, in some ways, I think, I don't know, you would know this, and I don't, we don't need to get into a discussion about this, but I think they're kind of a lucky little country in that they're little, and no one much wants them. I mean, they're not in anybody's sights,
yeah.
You know, for exploitation or overrunning or, you know, they're.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of been left alone, I think, and
mm-hmm.
to pursue their, you know, their life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. That's what I like about working with them on a regular basis. It's not China where there's 4 billion people, or 3 billion, whatever it is. There's a certain number of people, and they have a culture, and then they have a central government, which is very strong, of course, and controls the newspapers and a lot of the communications and everything. In a way, they're trying to do the best they can for their people, and they're small enough. They're now trying to take care of the minorities and the people in the country, and so it's really, really an interesting country, I think. Okay, and it's fun to go back there. It says, one of the questions is, have you ever been back to Vietnam?
No.
Okay. And here's a question. What do you think about U.S. military intervention into other countries?
Oh, geez. Yeah, I decline to answer that. Because I don't think there's a short answer, and I don't want to get into anything about that.
Okay. Uh-huh. You did put an answer down, and I thought it was pretty good, but... we'll go on to the next question. And let's see what is the next question going to be here. Here's one. Would you like to go back to Vietnam?
I'm too old.
Okay. Okay, if you were younger, maybe, huh?
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe not. A lot of people that I get asked that question that were there, but would say no. And
you know, again, the experience that I had was not typical. I mean, my feet hardly ever touched the ground, so I can't say that I had any relationship at all with. The country, the people, the culture, none of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you don't develop any kind of real interest in it or appreciation for it or anything like that.
Right.
I mean, we just floated around out there. And,
right.
So that's how I would explain that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went back with the guy one time that really... he only went back just because he had the opportunity to have a free flight. But he said his experience was he was drafted right after high school because he wasn't in college. He had about 2 months training. He was sent to Vietnam with an infantry unit, and he was a point man on many patrols. He spent 1 year there in and out of the jungle on missions, and he said at the end of the year, Let's see. Did he stay extra 6 months somehow? He said at the end of his time, he came back to the United States, and they discharged him from the Army, and he was back home again. And it was like a dream. He said, I didn't really meet people. I didn't know where I was. I mean, I knew I was in Vietnam, but I didn't know what I was doing there except for fighting people, and people were shooting at me. And I was, one day I was in the United States, the next day I was in Vietnam. A year later, I'm back in the United States, and I'm back on the street again. He said, it was just, I had really no interaction with people. Okay, here's one. Do you think the U.S. government takes care of its veterans today?
Say that again?
Well, do you think the U.S. government takes care of its veterans today?
You know, I would have no way to know that.
Okay. Yeah, because you're not a...
Other than what you hear, and that, I mean, I'm not a veteran. I'm not in that system. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who's a veteran, mm-hmm. and it seems to me that she's up to her ears in benefits, but
mm-hmm.
and has marvelous insurance. And
great,
but she doesn't get her care from a VA facility. She just
mm-hmm.
and she doesn't have any major problems. But I don't really know, Ken.
Okay. Yeah. In my case, they're doing just fine. They're taking care of us. They got our. I don't have any. Fortunately, I knock on wood here. I don't have any Agent Orange problems left over or anything like that. And you know, they call me in January to get a COVID-19 vaccine, which was right up front. So I got my two shots by February of the year, so I thought that was pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me see.
Are we about at the end?
Yeah, we got one more.
One more?
Yeah. Was it difficult? Two more. Was it difficult for you to adjust to life in the U.S. upon your return home?
No, because I went right back into the same job, same setting, the same
mm-hmm.
thing.
Okay.
It was not when I got back home.
Okay, well that's...
When I finally decided to leave the Red Cross, that was harder because that job doesn't feed into any other experience.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it was so unique that you couldn't say, it didn't particularly prepare you for
okay.
any other thing. So,
oh.
But we won't belabor that.
Okay.
Just
and,
no,
so,
the answer is no.
Okay, and so what'd you do after you after that experience? After
Well, we won't go into that. I mean, that was then the beginning of a long... I worked for the Red Cross, actually.
Okay.
The little local Red Cross, but that's uh-huh. not here, they're there.
Okay.
Okay, I'm hungry.
Okay. Well,
see, it's long past dinner time here.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for doing this,
wait
Mary.
Wait a minute, because I want to know. Are
what?
We done?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you're going to go to your reunion?
Yeah, we're going to do the reunion this weekend. And actually, we leave tomorrow. Isn't tomorrow Thursday? Yeah. And so we'll be in Clarinda, Iowa for the 61st Salt Helicopter Company reunion.
When are you leaving?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Yeah, and Pat's going
okay.
with me. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, that'll be exciting. That'll be a lot of, be some interesting people there, and we'll get to do things with several of the old buddies, and so that'll be great. And
that'll be great. Where is this in Iowa?
It's called Clarinda, Iowa. It's in the southern part of Iowa, and it's the hometown of, who is that? Famous musician in World War Glenn Miller. It's Glenn
oh,
Miller's.
Really?
It's Glenn Miller's hometown, and so there's a
oh,
Glenn Miller Museum there, and it's an interesting little place. And so that'll be a lot of fun, and we'll do some interviews there with their local newspapers and radio stations, and meet our friends there, and we'll have a former member of the band Kansas will entertain us, and we'll have the photographer from the guy that took the picture of the young girl who was burned in Vietnam, Nick Ut, he'll be there. And then the head of the Vietnam Oral History Project will do a Zoom meeting with him, Kelly Krager. So we got different things
planned. Agenda.
Yeah, yeah. And it'd be great if you would join us sometime.
Well, have a wonderful time.
Okay. And thank you very much for your time and effort. This has been great.
Ken, thank you. Uh-huh. Thank you for
getting
all this accomplished. I appreciate it, and thank you.
Okay.
And thank you.
You're most welcome, and thank you. And then enjoy your dinner this evening. And too bad you don't have any Philippine stewards to serve it to. Okay, we'll talk to you later, Meredith.
Okay, say hi to Pat.
Okay. Hi, Pat.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, so this is Ken Embers, and we're signing off. Bye.